As you heard, I'm third generation in this family business. If there's any problem, raise your hand. Feel free to yell. I've learned how to yell over the years working in this business. So now, if we could have the slideshow up, please. Like the dog, actually, at first. But so here we are. Now, as last year, many of you saw Evelyn speak last year. Now you get to hear me speak as well. So I'm sorry in advance. But like her, I'm in complete agreement. We're all very busy people. So it's important that we start with our conclusions. And some of the conclusions are the same as last year. The first being that our climate ebbs and flows. It's ever-changing. It doesn't follow a linear path. It doesn't follow a linear model. Every year, we have new developments that change the type of climate that we can expect. It's never going to be the same year after year, no matter how much we may want it to be. So in this case, we're being heavily affected by an El Niño that was officially declared in March of 2015. And it's continuing, and it's one of the strongest that we have historically recorded. Now, I'll explain what that means later on in the presentation, but it has been a very strong El Niño. In addition to this El Niño, we had the eruption of a volcano called Bartabunga. I see no D in the spelling of Bartabunga, but nonetheless, that is how it's pronounced. So we have the volcanic eruption of Bartabunga, and we have this strong El Niño. What this means is that combined, it changes the overall weather that we experience throughout the country. It means a wetter and cooler California. It means a wetter and cooler southern part of the states. It means drier and less rainfall in the northern parts of the U.S., hotter northeast. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't have strong storms. And in fact, we have oceanic oscillations right now that create stronger, more intense storms. So this is very important for the insurance industries in general, but most especially in agricultural insurance. And then last but not least is when you have strong El Niño, such as what we're currently experiencing, there is a very strong chance of a La Niña following very soon. Should we have this La Niña occur, the later in the year it occurs, the better it'll be for agriculture. But the earlier it occurs, the more detrimental it can be. Projections are ranging from late July through September or October. If it's late July or August, it can have a major effect on the soy pod filling during that time that occurs in August, which could create problems because you have a higher risk of drought with La Niñas in a lot of the agricultural areas. So with all this in mind, we, especially for your new, for the newer people, and so that you know that I follow in suit with Evelyn and what the business does, this is what we do. We follow energy, and we find it very important. We monitor the sun's activity. How strong is it? Where is the solar coming? The solar energy coming from? Is it, you know, a weak or a strong cycle? We've been following the solar flare monitoring for quite a while. But then, second to that, we monitor as it's coming into the Earth what might be blocking it. Now, I love my job. I love what I do. But I do admit I and probably most of us are actually in the wrong business. The reason I say this is they did a scientific study not too long ago. Millions of dollars were invested in this. Scientists actually became millionaires from it. And they discovered after years of analysis, when you're underneath a cloud, it's cooler. So after this amazing discovery, we were able to ascertain from that if it's cooler underneath the cloud, that means that energy, that solar energy, is being blocked. But it's not just cloud activity. It's volcanic activity. It's if it's just clear and open space. And when it hits the Earth, where does it land? Does it land in the ocean? Does it land on land? Is it hitting cities or rural areas more efficiently? Is it hitting a colder or a warmer part of the Atlantic, Pacific, or Indian Ocean? So we follow the energy from the sun. From the sun, through the skies, to the Earth. But along with that, we are historical climatologists. So we pay very close attention to the history of climate. And we get our history through a lot of data. Whenever you see in the press or the media, when it says worst fill-in-the-blank or best fill-in-the-blank in history, that history, long-term, is 50 years. Because most of the data that they utilize starts in the 1970s when we had satellite imagery. start to occur to be able to monitor various weather patterns. We go a bit further. We go hundreds of years back through old documents, ship logs, monk documentation. You might think of a monk as a holy person. We find them as a very intelligent small agribusiness man with a great skill at record keeping, because they would monitor their gardens, growth, and what was doing well year by year. But we go not just 50, not just hundreds, but even thousands of years back, looking at tree rings, looking at coral rings, looking at ice cores. We utilize lots of various forms of data that gives us, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, year-to-year analysis of weather all throughout the varying continents. We can know when it's been colder, warmer, wetter, drier for thousands of years. And with this, we're able to ascertain why things are happening now, because we've been able to see why things were happening in the past, and it can give us a better understanding of why things are going to occur in the future. And so our current, why things are happening now, a lot of it has to do with Godzilla versus a volcano. And Evelyn, would you like to explain?
I get the fun part. Yes, they are giving this particular strong El Nino some intriguing names like Godzilla or Bruce Lee. Any way of conveying to you that this beast is a strong one. But the El Nino tends to affect tropical weather. It is a tropical phenomenon. And it is in conflict with a polar volcano, good old Bartabunga, that went off in Iceland. And the two of those are shaping the weather that you get to ensure crops. Now, let me explain how a volcano works. First of all, notice in the upper left-hand corner, there's some volcanic ash. It's not like the floating ash you see in your fire. It's shattered volcanic glass. It is reflective. And what we have discovered is when a volcano is strong enough that it puts that debris high into the atmosphere, that reflective glass and the chemicals can block out incoming sunlight for years. And we see a three-step process. First, the debris blocks out incoming sunlight, and it cools whatever part of the earth is under the floating debris, the clouds of the debris. Secondly, when you cool down the air, you affect atmospheric pressure. And atmospheric pressure shapes winds. Wind direction, and even the jet stream. And number three, what goes up must come down. What we have discovered is this debris, as it floats, collects water. See the picture in the upper right-hand corner? See the normal size of a raindrop? Compare that to the size of the raindrops when you have volcanic ash collecting water. You end up with these thick clouds of micro droplets that are too small to fall out. And so they continue to accumulate. For example, we had a volcano go off in 1991, Pinatubo in the Philippines. It had five eruptions, 15 to 20 miles high, in the period of a week. It put up so much debris that the clouds ended up covering the Earth from 20 degrees south of the equator all the way to the North Pole. Some of those clouds measured 10 miles thick. They cooled off.
All right.
They cooled off the globe 0.5 degree. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but if you cool the globe 1 degree Fahrenheit, you bring the freeze zone down 300 miles. That's going to affect a crop. Now, it sounds more impressive in Canadian. If you cool the globe 1 degree centigrade, it moves the freeze zone down 1,000 kilometers. And the Canadians go, ooh. When Pinatubo went off, it cooled the globe. It caused some floods 2 years later when the rain finally fell out. Now, that was number one. Number two, remember I said it changed the wind direction? Well, if you have a volcano go in Russia, it changes the jet stream, and the jet stream drops in the middle of the country. I like to call this Russia's little Cold War against Texas. But look what happens on the right-hand side. When you have an Icelandic volcano, and these are fairly rare, we've only had three go off this century, it makes the jet stream across the eastern United States much stronger. And so you end up with a lot of that cold air that normally would have been dropping down in the eastern U.S. all year long, trapped north. And it also does some of the same things for Europe. Let's look at the 3 years in the last century prior to Bartabunga when we had an Icelandic volcano. Notice all three kept most of the Great Lakes area, the Midwest, eastern provinces of Canada, and the eastern northeastern U.S. warmer than average. When you had an El Nino streaming cold air along the bottom tier of the states, like in 1919, you can see the pattern. But El Ninos shape warm winters in the eastern United States overall. Compare what we saw this year in December with most standard Icelandic. We were warning our clients about this weeks earlier. I mean, weeks earlier, about 4 months earlier.
Give or take, yes.
Yeah, and we have some, for example, some peach growers that we work with that have had a very difficult year because they need temperatures to get a certain level of coldness for their fruit and vegetable crops. But see, it follows historical patterns. And if you know anything about the history, then you have perspective and you can get prepared. Now, I've talked a lot about volcanoes because they're fun. You get to talk about the water.
Yes. I get to talk about the elephant of the earth, or really the bulk of it. The majority of our earth is ocean, and we monitor it very, very closely. But it's not just, oh, we look at the Atlantic, we look at the Pacific. That'd be really easy, and it's never that easy. Instead, we look at a bunch of varying factors. We look at MJOs, Madden-Julian oscillations. I like to call these the toilet flushes of the Pacific. And you think, well, that sounds a little gross. Why would he say that? If you've ever taken a shower and somebody flushes the toilet, and it doesn't even have to be in your toilet, it can be an apartment or a hotel room further down, you suddenly get a blast of hot or cold air, or hot or cold water. Well, the same thing happens with the Madden-Julian oscillation. It's a blast of hot or cold water, and it can completely alter the general outlook of the weather that we're going to get from the Pacific. In 2013, we were actually starting to develop, 2014, we were actually starting to develop El Nino conditions from the Pacific, and one little cold Madden-Julian oscillation brought the temperatures down just enough to end that cycle and start it over. Along with that, we monitor the IOD, the Indian Ocean Dipole, which for the U.S. isn't of great importance, but by God, in Australia, Southern Asia, and Africa, they monitor that thing like their pulse, because that ocean's that oscillation really determines how their precipitation patterns and monsoon seasons are going to go. With that, we monitor the monsoons very carefully. In the U.S., we have our four seasons, summer, spring, winter, fall, for those of you that didn't know that. But in many other countries, they don't have that. They just have wet season and dry season. And the monsoons, where they land, how strong they are, how far inland they go, and how long they last, help determine whether it was a good or a bad year, whether it was a dry, a wet, or a moderate season. We pay attention to El Niños and La Niñas. We're going to talk a lot about El Niños and La Niñas during this presentation because they are the major contributor to the weather that we're experiencing in the U.S. and North America, and it's actually affecting global weather in general. We monitor the PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation. I'm going to give you a couple terms you get to drop later on at various parties. Make yourself sound more impressive because I do it all the time. PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, a 50 to 60 year cycle, 25 to 30 years warm, 25 to 30 years cold. And it has massive influence on the weather that we have in Western North America, in South America, and for that matter, in Eastern Asia. And we monitor AMO, Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, a longer cycle, 60 to 70 years, 30 to 35 years warm, 30 to 35 years cold. These two cycles have shifted recently. The PDO shifted in 2005, the AMO shifted in 1995, and we'll go into a bit of detail on how that has changed the type of weather that we were experiencing today versus what we were experiencing in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when we created a lot of our economic, agricultural, industrial foundations that we live by today. So as you can see, it's not a simple cut and dry. There's a lot of gears that work in this clock of our global oceans. But if the gears are working properly, you always know what time it is. And that's why we follow the ocean so closely, because we can always have a better understanding of what they're going to be doing. So this is what they're doing. Right now, these are the current conditions that we're experiencing in the oceans around the world. And these are the oceanic actions that are affecting the climate and weather that we have currently. We have the El Nino, the strong El Nino, which is bringing hot water into the western parts of North America and South America, and bringing colder temperatures into Eastern Asia and Southeastern Asia. That hot water is pushing hot water down into the western part of South America. We have a neutral IOD. That neutral Indian Ocean dipole has been a saving grace for agriculture all around that area, because normally an El Nino means very bad news for India, Indonesia, Australia, and parts of Africa. The fact that it got warmer helped to alleviate some of the stressors that were happening with agriculture last year. They were so bad that you had farmers in India committing suicide instead of wanting to deal with another year of really bad weather. We have the very cold blob up there in the north eastern part, just off of the northeastern part of the U.S., which, from everything we can tell, has been the effect of Bartabunga. There's that volcano rearing its head again. And not only is that cold blob there, which has helped create a lot of drought last year in Europe, but is keeping hot water there along the eastern part of the United States, of North America. And what that has meant is that we have had warm conditions in that area, but it's also meant that we have all that energy building and building, which is why you're having record-breaking snowfall. If you look at temperatures overall statistically, it's been a very warm. You saw the map that Evelyn showed you not too long ago, but that's not what the media has been covering. They've been covering the massive snowstorms. Gets better pops, gets more clicks on their views, and it also is more affecting to people in the cities. If it's a hot winter, that means nothing is happening, but if they get 2 feet of snow, that's going to really catch their attention. So these are the oceanic effects that we are experiencing right now that are having such a dramatic impact on our global climate.
One thing just to notice back there. See number 8? That's Hurricane Alex. The Atlantic was so blasted warm that we had a January hurricane.
Interesting thing with that, it started out as a very small storm way down there in the southeastern part of the U.S. It took days for it to become a hurricane, but it eventually did so, and it was the first one we'd had since the 1930s to start in January. So we talked about the oceans, and I said we'd go into a bit more detail of the AMO and the PDO, and I'm going to let Evelyn take over about the AMO.
This is the granddaddy cycle, the one that lasts about 70 years. And all we're talking about is the Gulf Stream. Is it going to flow fast or slow? If it flows fast, it carries a lot of tropical water north, and things get very hot. If it's slow, the North Atlantic cools. And what they have discovered, and they started discovering this back in the 1700s, is that there is a cycle of about 40 years of fast and a hot Atlantic, and 30 years cold, 40, 30, 40, 30. And once we knew the pattern and could look at tree rings, we have traced this pattern going back for thousands of years. And you can see there's breaks in it. When they took actual measurements, you can have a warm cycle with a cold year in it. But basically, once it starts, and this warm cycle started in 1995, you end up with a hot Atlantic for about 40 years. So we now are halfway through this warm cycle, and we have this hot water and a lot of energy off our coast. We see it in our hot summers. We see it in our exciting winters. Have you noticed? When we have had storms this year, they have been major storms. Look at Goliath that did such incredible damage to the dairy cattle industry in Texas. Look at Jonas, which hogged the headlines. I mean, Washington, D.C. got paralyzed with one blasted inch of snow, and then Jonas dumped the kitchen sink on it. What is happening is there's so much hot water, and it's heating the air, and hot air holds more moisture. So when cold hits it, boom, you get a major storm. So this is what we were getting. Overall, some hotter temperatures, and when it finally storms, it's incredible. Now, the three factors causing these storms, and what I'm saying is these are not just flukes. We're seeing a big storm come now. Expect these types of harsh storms to continue in springtime as well. The El Niño is creating these hot atmospheric rivers where hot streams of tropical moisture pour north. And when you hear about Pineapple Expresses, you hear about the storms. Did you notice while the headlines concentrated on Jonas, the West Coast was getting all sorts of moisture? That's El Niño atmospheric rivers. Think of a stream of water, hundreds of times more moisture than the Mississippi River, flowing through the atmosphere and aimed at us. When that mixes with some of the regular storms, it makes for a superstorm. Also, the Atlantic is very hot, creating a lot of humidity. And then, remember I showed you that debris from Bartabunga? When you have all those micro droplets, you have more droplets. And so you get, when it snows, the snows are heavier. And then it gets hot, the snows melt, and you get floods like you had in late December in the Midwest. And there you can see, this is the state of our rivers and streams. They are, thanks to the extreme storms and then the followed by melt, they get very high. And it's sort of exciting. We get to see how well our infrastructure has been maintained. Now, this is a 40-year pattern that tends to last. It has another 20 years if it follows history. And the warm phase of the AMO, because it adds more energy, it makes the trade winds, which blow from east to west, stronger. Now, back when the Atlantic was cool, we had weak trade winds. The spinning of the earth tended to torque that moisture up through the Gulf. And so during that 30-year cycle of a cold Atlantic, you had more frequent, better rainfall throughout the Midwest and the Southern Plains. Now with a stronger, hotter Atlantic, droughts are more frequent. Also, when you have energy, you've created a playground for hurricanes. And we have started seeing more hurricanes. I had one of my clients complaining to me in 1996 because he had invested right when the Atlantic turned. He built a multi-million dollar beach house. And he was saying, I've had three hurricanes come close to my house. What is happening? And I said, why do you think where you live is called Cape Fear? Why do you think Native Americans didn't live there? Welcome to the new normal. Okay, I've talked about the Atlantic. You get to talk about our friend El Nino, the Godzilla.
The Godzilla El Nino. So technically what we're saying is the Godzilla boy, which doesn't sound nearly as intimidating, but for those of you curious, who here wants to know the difference between what to expect between El Nino and La Nina? You see, when we have an El Nino, it was discovered in Peru, and it was discovered that during a time of an El Nino, warm water came and it created better rainfall, and it started good agricultural growth during the time of Christmas. And so during Christmas in Peru, they remember not the boy, but the boy, the Christ child. And so when they're saying El Nino, it's the warm, wonderful boy, because it's a reflection of the Christ child. Now, I'd like to believe that the scientists who discovered this and then discovered the La Nina had a really bad breakup with their girlfriend at some point. And so they were going to remember her by naming the cold water that came and bombarded the North America and South America and created dryness and drought after that lady that they fell out of care about. And so, unfortunately, La Nina is a really cold-hearted...
So, lady.
El Nino is the boy, La Nina, the girl. El Nino, warmth and good precipitation. La Nina, coldness and dry precipitation. Or not dry precipitation, but drought and dryness. And so you can see just from these two kind of the difference in the type of rainfall and water that you get coming off the coasts when you have a warm El Nino or a cold La Nina. And this is the way that it's monitored. We have 20-plus different groups that monitor the Pacific oceanic temperatures. And they keep track of if it's getting warmer or colder than average. And when it gets warmer, half a degree Celsius warmer than normal, than the average, that means that you're starting to have an El Nino. Half a degree Celsius cooler, you're having a La Nina. And if you look at that 3.4, El Nino 3.4, that's the area that they monitor. Now, they discovered this in the 70s and 80s, and unfortunately, we had a very different Pacific then than we do today. And so this level of measurement is kind of difficult now for a lot of the people that monitor the El Nino. You see, in 2014, like I said before, we had 5 months in a row where the Pacific waters were half a degree or higher Celsius in temperature. So we had El Nino conditions. That 6 month, we had that cold MJO pop up, lowered it to 0.4 degrees Celsius instead of 0.5, cut it off, and restarted the whole trend. At which point, that's when you had the 7 months that led to the March official declaration of an El Nino. So what that meant for anybody who's dependent on weather, most of 2014, you were living in an El Nino. Didn't even know it. But it wasn't officially declared because it didn't follow this very strict modeled structure that most of these groups utilize. So we
always tell our clients when you're living in El Nino conditions. But the scientists don't tell you until you've lived through 7 months of it.
Yep. So what the science, however, we do keep track because they're very good at monitoring the temperatures. And that's information that we have because that would be a long trek for me every day to go out to the middle of the Pacific and try to see what the temperature is. So in general, what they're seeing is that through spring and into early summer, we're likely to continue experiencing El Nino conditions, but it's going to cool down. And there's a good chance that by the end of summer into early fall, we will start experiencing a La Nina. And so when it comes to El Nino for the remainder of winter, this is the type of weather and temperatures and precipitation patterns that we can experience. We have wetter, more precipitation in the southern parts of the states and in the western parts, and we have cooler, drier conditions in the northeast and the east. But with that eruption of Bartabunga, with all that energy that's being trapped, it does mean that you get very severe storms. And so statistically, it might actually show you average conditions when it comes to precipitation, if you look at just a chart or a map. But what it's not telling you is most of that rainfall, most of that snowfall came over the course of 3 days throughout the month, as opposed to a few inches in week one, a few more in week three, and a bit more in week four.
And these are the type of storms that you have to insure against.
Yep.
A month's worth of rain in a few days.
So right now we're seeing the nation outlook from these maps. What we want to do now, we're going to break it regionally down for you, and we're going to show you 1997-98, which was the last time we had an El Nino as close to as strong as what we're currently experiencing.
Yeah, here you can see what happened in the eastern United States. And you can see cold, and you can see precipitation. You know, it's interesting. Back last August, I was reading the local Washington, D.C. weathermen warning Washington, D.C. that they were going to have huge amounts of snow. And you know what? They still weren't even prepared for an inch of it. But history tends to repeat itself if you have the same weather phenomenon hitting the same spot. And you can see the El Nino tends to put a lot of moisture along the southern parts of the East Coast, and you tend to get a lot of warmth there in the northern part. Now, it's broken by a single storm, but overall tends to be warmer.
Yep. When we're looking at the Great Lakes region, we actually are looking at good amounts of precipitation and rainfall, but it's generally drier. You're not going to get the
warmer.
You're not going to get the refrigerator effect that you had a couple years ago where the Great Lakes were staying frozen up until April. It's going to help with transportation. It's going to provide relatively decent early spring precipitation and rainfall for the development of agriculture and cattle.
Now, when you get to the southern area, and here we're talking winter wheat and cattle country, it frequently is warmer. And if we didn't very carefully put our label over it, you would see all that moisture. And again, remember the moisture tends to come in one big spurt. But notice, history doesn't always repeat itself. Notice northern Texas is a little wetter there. You don't see, last time we had a strong El Nino, we did not have the type of heavy snow that killed, I've heard estimates from 22 to 30,000 head of cattle.
The southeast, we actually are experiencing somewhat similar phenomenons, though not as strong this year. But we're having good amounts of precipitation in the southeastern part of the U.S., lots of rainfall, lots of snowfall, but we're not having quite the extreme storm risk that we're having last year, and that's because so much of that energy is actually being trapped further in the northeast. But we still have enough rainfall and precipitation that we have a risk of the fungal infections and a risk of rough crop startups and the fact that we're not going to have the bug killings that normally a colder winter would bring. So it means that anything growing over the winter is at a higher risk of fungal, of rot, of disease, and it's going to be slightly harder conditions for starting the spring and the early spring planting.
And just recently we were in Nebraska and pointing out this warmer weather and that most of the area would be getting adequate moisture, so they would have good conditions for spring and actually good conditions to start early planting, especially with that hot Atlantic. I remember hearing one insurance person saying to the clients, start planting early. So this is what we've seen most strong El Ninos. And notice one of the problems besides warmer and less insect kill is when you start getting around Kansas, Oklahoma, some parts of Nebraska, some areas end up with less snow cover for winter wheat.
And then finally we have California. Now this is the one that can have the most dramatic difference. And that's because in the time that we had this El Nino, 97-98, the Pacific was warm. It wasn't cold like it is now. So when you had the warm El Nino merge with the warm Pacific, it made everything warmer. And so we had very intense heat and energy coming from the Pacific, and it created, at times, record-breaking rainfall in all throughout California. And it left the Northwest relatively dry. What we're seeing now, because we had a cold Pacific and the El Nino is coming in, is that we're still getting good rainfall for California, but a lot of it is settling further north. It's hitting a bit more of the Northwest. And when you start getting into the southern part of California, they're getting rainfall, but it's not as much as they did in 97 and 98. And it, much like other parts of the U.S., was coming in quick, really strong bursts. So that's why, especially in September, October, and November, you were hearing about flooding in California. Because once again, the thing to keep in mind, whenever you have a lot of rain in any area that's been experiencing drought for a prolonged period of time, that soil is dry. It's not going to absorb rainfall very easily, and it increases the risks of flash flooding. So looking region to region of then and now we're looking at today, this is what we can expect for late winter and into early and mid-spring. We're getting warm temperatures up in the northeast and the northern parts, and more wetness and coolness during in the southern part and western part of the United States. Once we get into early and in, especially more into mid-spring, expect some last late winter, early spring, snow or rainstorms especially to hit the northeast. Some of the wetness is going to break down a little bit in the west, and that rainfall will end by mid-spring more than likely in the southern parts of the U.S. We can anticipate more than likely something akin to what happened last year in Texas and other parts of the south where their drought got ended, but it wasn't in a fun little, you know, couple inches here, couple inches there. It was basically a cloud exploded over them over the course of a couple days, and it ended their drought, and then it was dry after that.
And notice there was also California typically gets a miracle March or an amazing April, last burst of heavy moisture.
Mm-hmm. And so most moderate El Niños, which is what we can experience, what we can consider to occur by mid to late spring, this is what we can experience when it comes to precipitation and temperature. We're looking at cooler south, warmer north, and pay close attention to the eastern corn belt. That area oftentimes struggles with getting needed precipitation. They might get a storm here and there, but in general, the amount of rainfall that they get is much drier and much lower than normally occurs during the other parts of the other years when you don't have as strong an El Nino. And I'm going to let Evelyn explain to you about how the La Nina should affect us in the upcoming months.
Okay. We are going to be experiencing an absolute smorgasbord of exotic weather. The reason we brought up La Nina is because most years where you have a strong El Nino, where the temperatures in that crucial area are hotter than 2 degrees centigrade above normal, look how rapidly a La Nina started. And remember, they don't declare it La Nina. You just have La Nina, dry, lousy weather. 72, 73, it hit in June, 3 months. 4 months in 82, 83. 2 months. And it hit, normally it would hit in late summer, early fall. And it's crucial which of those it hits. If a La Nina occurs, this is a type of weather it normally brings to late summer, early fall. And as you can see, it's not good news, especially for the eastern Corn Belt, which already may have had some difficulties with spring. Now, it's crucial. When does it hit? If it hits in July, that's when the corn is silking and the ears, the kernels are being set on the ear. If it's August, that's when soybean pods fill. The rain is crucial. If it hits after August, or if the soybeans were planted early, then you are stuck with a warm, dry, pleasant harvest season. Then, if it really does develop into a La Nina, and history suggests that it will, notice this is a normal pattern of weather. And where do we see the dry weather? Well, we tend to see it in California and Florida. And to some extent, history suggests along the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. What are we talking about? We're talking about vegetables and fruit. Every single winter vegetable and fruit area in the U.S. tends to have trouble if it is a La Nina winter. Now, the last time you saw a hot Atlantic and a full-blown La Nina was called 2012. I'm not suggesting a repeat of that. I'm just refreshing your memory. Okay, I've talked about short-term stuff. Give them the long perspective.
The last cycle that we're looking at, the Pacific, the PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation. In the 70s through the 70s through the 90s, we had a warm Pacific on the eastern part of the Pacific and a cold on the western. So it was warm along North America. This created relatively good precipitation patterns, especially for the states west of the Rockies. In 2005, it shifted, and it became cold. And that was its tipping point. And as it's gotten colder, we've had drier conditions. This is one of the reasons California has had so much drought. And even the drought, which is good for, well, two crops, wine and opium. So, you know...
You don't care about the weather.
Exactly. But even wine, the more legal one of these two, unfortunately with that, a lot of this dryness creates fires, and you have the risk of smoke damage to the grapes. So dry California, not a good thing just in general. But what we're looking at now, we have our cold Atlantic, and we have our hot Atlantic, we have our cold Pacific. The top right is the precipitation patterns that we had from the 70s through the 90s.
Yeah, top left, yeah.
I'm sorry, the top left, thank you. And I've heard people refer to it as the good old days. Now, I have heard stories of this time frame. It wasn't great every day of every year, but since it was back then and not now, it was perfect. Just ask. But as you can see, what it was is you had relatively strong precipitation patterns throughout a majority of the United States. And that rainfall was more dependable and it was less extreme. It came in short bursts over long periods of time instead of a lot over a short period of time. The top right image now is what we call our new normal, based on the oceanic trends that we're seeing today. This is when we don't have El Niños or La Niñas or Bartabungas or other volcanoes messing with the normal. And this is the type of rainfall and precipitation patterns that we get, which a lot less area is getting good rainfall. You have a lot higher risk of drought, but there are some areas, if you notice, they're in the central part of the United States. Back in the day and now today, they get good rainfall either way. And it's a reason that farming land in that area has become much higher in value. It's because that's an area that hasn't been experiencing the extreme ups and downs that most of the rest of the U.S. has been having to endure. The bottom left is what we see when we have an El Niño. And this is when the southern part of the United States needs to figure out how to utilize water most efficiently. I've had farmers ask me in the past, you know, if they were going to do any major change to their farming system or to their land, to their crops, what would be, you know, the suggestion? And the thing that I always tell them is figure out how to save and conserve water. Building reservoirs, having less water used for crop watering, whatever you can do. It's not the most fun thing to do, but the reason is because El Niño is the only time for the next 15 to 20 years that the South can get good rainfall. And even then, that good rainfall comes in extreme storms, not over the course of an entire summer. So the utilization of water becomes that much more important. And so now we're looking at the neutral Pacific, which is what we currently have. Well, not neutral, but we have the hot Pacific. And we basically have our various comparisons of the precipitation patterns under the new normal and under an El Niño. And we have the agricultural spread, where we're growing things along the U.S. And it's a very rough map, but it gives you kind of a generalized visual idea of where the rainfall hits and what crops and or growing conditions it affects the most. And then finally, billion-dollar cost insurance claims. If you've noticed, they've gone up dramatically over the past 10 years. 10 years when the PDO changed in 2005. But it's not just that the PDO changed in 2005. It was that from the 70s through the 90s, we had very good weather patterns, very good climate. We've had people, more and more people and populations coming into the U.S. We were having more people moving into small spaces, into cities. We're having more people moving close to coasts. And we're continuing to grow our agricultural land that we're utilizing. And so notice the amount of claims that are extremely high that have come from storm damage, from extreme storms, that have come from flooding, that have come from drought. Notice even in 2012, the year that it was dry and everything was really rough and there was no rainfall, we still had a lot of claims that came from extreme storms. Because even when you don't have a lot of rainfall, it means when you do have it, it's going to be that much more intense because you've had dry land that entire time. This is to point out that, and for the next 10 to 15, if not even 20 years, we have more extreme weather patterns. We have more extreme climate. It doesn't mean good or bad. It just means what has been occurring in the past, and we can see it through the claims, and what's likely to be occurring for the next 10 to 20 years. And this brings us back to our conclusions. We have our weather, ebbs and flows, ever-changing, doesn't follow a linear path.
And what we're seeing now is similar weather to what we saw in the 1950s. The U.S. fed the world in the 1950s. It just was not casual.
Exactly. We have the effect of the El Nino along with the action of Bartabunga. Those are the two major influences on our current climate that's different from that new normal that you saw earlier. It's creating different precipitation patterns throughout the U.S., wetter and cooler south and west, warmer and drier north and northeast. But we still have the extreme patterns of rainfall, and we still have the extreme storms that can make the overall precipitation statistically be normal. But it doesn't say that it came over the course of a few days as opposed to a few weeks. And finally, we have the effect of the La Nina. Should it come earlier in the summer, it can have an impact on the corn or soy production in the Central Plains and Midwest. Should it come by September, we're looking at a more positive ability of a drier harvesting season, which, hearing everything that happened last year, I'm willing to bet they look forward to if that's the case. And we are Browning Media. We do a monthly bulletin. We do these presentations and consult. We also, near the end of each year, actually do a following year outlook month to month, similar to some of the maps that we've been showing throughout this presentation, specific for insurance companies so that they can utilize it when they're having to make their adjustments coming at the end of the year. And if you are interested in that, feel free to ask us, grab a card, or put your name and email address. We'll have a little sign-up sheet there. Thank you very much, everybody, for taking the time to listen
Thank
to
you.
Us, and we welcome any questions.
Questions?
Yes.
Jim, let me give you the mic here.
Hi, Jim Constani, Partner Re. Really enjoyed your presentation. We just need a little clarification. So you had mentioned about the Atlantic Ocean is getting really warm now.
Yes.
I think, right? But then there's that Icelandic volcano that's throwing up the clouds of reflecting glass.
Yes.
Which seems to indicate that things are going to cool. So could you, I'm a little confused about, is it going to be hot, but it's going to get cold, or how does it go?
Okay, the Gulf Stream is flowing very, very fast. So there's a lot of hot tropical water coming north. The cold from this eruption has blocked some of the flow. So what we're actually seeing is a, what's basically would be a 20, 30 year period of more hot water. Remember we showed occasionally it gets interrupted? We're seeing an interrupted period, and what's happening is that cold water where they're still feeling the effects of Bartabunga and its eruption is halting the flow of the Gulf Stream or slowing it so that a lot of that hot water, because the Gulf Stream's still flowing really fast, is pinned up along our shores. And I admit to being somewhat concerned because this is putting a lot of heat off our shores for spring. And we could see some of the type of early spring planting conditions that we saw in 2012, which was the last time that we saw a very hot Atlantic.
But in the end, the cold is what's going to dissipate.
Yes.
It's what's going to start going away. It's going to maintain the heat and the hot oscillation for the next 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, storms are going to end up finally submerging most of that ash. And so it'll go back to the normal hot flow. This is a temporary interruption, making for an intriguing year to ensure crops.
Yeah. Other questions? All right, one back here.
Beth Bierke with American Farm Bureau Insurance. What would you say that the next steps should be for the ag industry to effectively navigate climate change?
Obviously, money being... I'm saying all this with the concept of money is free-flowing and won't be a problem, so keep that in mind. The biggest things I would look at, one is any form and ability to utilize water more efficiently. Through reservoir systems, through infrastructure, through lower water use and crop growth and crop production, or even turning to crops that have lower water use. California, this past year, had profits in their agricultural sector, which they hadn't had in the previous years before. But the reason for that was not because they got a great amount of rainfall and conserved it properly. It was because they took all their high water use crops, got rid of them, and went to low water use crops.
And switch to the high-yielding value crops.
Mm-hmm. So that would be first. The second is that politically and policy-making, we have more and more attempts at altering and changing what can and can't be used for heating, for cooling. We're having more of a push towards cleaner energy, low-carbon use, et cetera, so forth. Fair or unfair, that is the direction that currently things are going. So if we are seeing the actions of different policymakers leaning towards a certain direction, anybody that can jump in front of that are going to save themselves a lot of drama in the years to come. So it isn't so much that you need to kowtow to whatever leanings policymakers have, but up until most recently with the coal industry, we just recently had the Supreme Court block the actions of the reductions in energy use by 27 states filing suit against it. But before then, the only coal industries that looked like they were going to survive, and a lot of them still died despite this, were the ones that were too big to fail. And let's be honest, when it comes to agriculture, there's not a lot of those around. Second were the coal companies that actually started implementing more environmentally friendly technology into their business plan prior to these policies coming into play, because it's not like it snuck up on them. They had 5 to 6 years of attempts of these sort of attempts happening. We are seeing a lot of attacks on agricultural in general, and agricultural and ranching, that cows produce too much methane and we're using too much fertilizer and it's too much CO2 and et cetera, so forth. If that continues to play, the ability to take action to be proactive against it instead of being bombarded by it when it actually happens is going to be a secondary action that can be taken that can help be prepared for the long-term future.
All right.
Any other questions? And I hope that kind of answered it. I know it's a bit long-winded.